Right now, most churches are planning their budgets for 2009. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the sponsors page at issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today.
I've come to know this God of love who loves me as a gay man, and now God is leading us to the full inclusion of gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered people.
It's very hard trying to do the Lord's work in the city of Satan.
Make no mistake, as someone who used to teach constitutional law, I believe deeply in separation of church and state.
The first Reformation was about belief. This one needs to be about behavior. It's not about creeds, it's about deeds.
Deeds, not creeds. In other words, we're going to stand before God now on the basis of our works and prove thereby that we're Christian.
Well, I made no secret of the fact that I am a six-day creationist. I read the book of Genesis, in particular the first two or three chapters, as they present themselves in a plain and simple way. Now, I cannot claim to fully understand how that fits within all the other evidence or so-called evidence that's thrown around in casual conversation by Christians and non-Christians regarding the age of the earth. But I guess that would also make me a young earth creationist. That is relatively young. So, what is the age of the earth? Some would tell us almost incalculably old. Others would say no, relatively young. Can't be both. Dr. David Menton joins us here for the first half of this Hour of Issues, etc., to answer some of our questions about the age of the earth. You can join us as well, 1-877-623-MY-IE, 877-623-6943. You can also email questions or comments to us right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org. In about a half hour, we'll conclude our conversation with Dr. Arthur Just. We've been talking about the threefold office of Christ, prophet, priest, and king. Today, Jesus as king. 1-877-623-MY-IE. Talk back at issuesetc.org. Dr. David Menton is a regular guest speaker for Answers in Genesis based in Petersburg, Kentucky, associate professor of anatomy at Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Menton, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be back again. Good to have you folks on the air.
This is not the only email of this kind that I've received, but I read an email from Teresa in Maple Grove, Minnesota. She says, I would like to make a suggestion for a topic that could possibly be discussed on your show. Could you discuss creationism? The reason why I'm suggesting this topic is because it was brought up last weekend during a get-together with some neighbors. They made the comment that they thought that vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin was a wacko for believing that the earth is only about 6,000 years old. They said that that was the stupidest thing they had ever heard because we all know that the earth is billions of years old. When I mentioned that I didn't believe exactly that, but that the earth was relatively young, they stared at me like I'd said I also believe that the earth is flat. They jumped all over me with carbon dating and how a fossil was recently dated at 4 billion years old. I did my best to explain my thoughts, but I was really weak when it came to explaining how the facts of science were not as concrete or certain as they seemed to think. How would you respond to Teresa's concern out there in Minnesota?
Well, it's certainly something we all hear a great deal, and many people are very, very confident that the Earth is very old, and in fact, it's almost unthinkable that the Earth could be the 6,000 years or so that historical narrative of the Old Testament certainly seems to indicate, and looking at the genealogies and what have you. You know, when somebody says, how can you believe that the Earth is only 6,000 years old, or how can you believe that it's not 4.5 billion years old, for example, I think a good question or a good answer is another question. What do you find as the most compelling evidence that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old? In other words, get them to talk a little bit. quite often you'll find that the confidence people have in the age of a fossil or the Earth or whatever is inversely proportional to how much they know about it. A lot of people, when you say, how do you know the dinosaurs died off 70 million years ago or 65 million years, they'll say, well, they're old. What do you mean they're old? Well, they're fossils. You know, what do you mean they're fossils? Well, fossils are old. Smoke them out. See what their confidence is really based on. I think what you'll typically find is their confidence is based on simply trusting in the authority of another person. And so a Christian might trust in the authority of God's word, and they're trusting in the authority of someone who is a scientist, and they are selecting their authority. You'll find that they oftentimes cannot really articulate what the actual evidence is for the age.
Okay, let's talk about a few of the things that do come up in particular. Fossil formation. From what we know of the fossils that we have been digging up for probably what, at least in a way of scientific enterprise, perhaps two centuries, does it take millions of years for fossils to form?
No, of course not. Even the evolutionary literature or geological literature points out that how long it takes a fossil to form can vary from fossil to fossil, but in general, it has to be quite quick. For example, fossils generally include at least, say, bones. In the case of vertebrates, you may not have much of the soft tissue preserved in bones, but even bones don't hang around forever. And not only do we see bones in fossils, but oftentimes the bones are attached one to another. We call that articulated. Now, when a creature dies, it doesn't take very long for those bones to become disjointed and become separate. And then it doesn't take very long for the bones to break down. If this were not so, we'd be walking through a few miles depth of bones on Earth from all of the creatures that died before us. So the fossilization process has to be quick enough to, at the very least, preserve bones. But oftentimes we see more than bone. I have a fossil fish sitting at my desk here where you can actually see the meat of the fish, the scales and what have you. And so here was a fish that was fossilized before the fish could rot or before a scavenger could eat it. And I believe when we see fossils of that type, well, we're talking minutes, hours at the most for the duration of forming that fossil before a predator could eat it, before bacteria could rot it. So if fossils form quickly, we can't say that fossils are old because it takes so long to form them. The entire layer that you see the fossil in must be of approximately the same age. After all, we can't believe that the dorsal fin of a fish is X million years younger than a ventral fin in the same fossil just because it occurs higher in the layer. So the whole layer containing the fossil has to be formed very, very quickly. Here at the Creation Museum, we have fossils of fish eating fish, and the fish never even got completely horsed down before they both got fossilized. So where is the old age? It's not in the fossil. Estimates of a very old age for a fossil really comes from the presumed time that transpired between the layers. Well, there's nothing between the layers except interpretation.
Okay, the time, what people think is, and this is how they picture it in their mind, you go to, say, the Grand Canyon, and you have perhaps better than a mile of strata that are exposed from top to bottom, and they assume that it must have taken millions, hundreds of millions, perhaps even upward of billions of years for all of those layers to have been laid down. And then, of course, they think that each one of those layers is going to contain kind of a very clear timeline record of animals at various stages of evolution, various species rising and falling. Is that what you actually find?
Well, I've made three visits now to Grand Canyon. I've hiked it rim to rim and about 40 miles down its length. I'm not an expert in geology, but I can tell you this. When you go to Grand Canyon, if there was any place that they could put a sign up saying, notice the evolution happening, believe me, they would have a sign there saying that. But in fact, you see no signs of that kind because, in fact, there is no evolutionary story in Grand Canyon. It's about, as far as I know, the largest exposure, the geologic column. In North America, we have rocks that presumably are foundational rocks to the Earth itself, not sedimentary, but igneous rock. all the way up to, according to modern geological terms, the age of the reptiles and dinosaurs. So we ought to have bones of fish, we ought to have bones of amphibians, we ought to have bones of reptiles in Grand Canyon. You ought to be able to go in there and scoop them up by the thousands. But in fact, to my knowledge, nobody has ever found a fossilized bone in Grand Canyon. Now, how can that be? We find footprints, for example, in the Coconino, which is sometimes called the bathtub ring of Grand Canyon. It's a kind of a light ring that you can see going all the way around. It's not at the very top. It's about three layers down from the top layer. It's called the Coconino. It's a cross-bedded sandstone. And in that layer, we find footprints of just countless what appear to be amphibians and reptiles, mostly fairly smallish creatures. I visited the Coconino going down the Hermit Trail here a few years ago, and I took pictures of just hundreds of fossilized footprints of these creatures. But, you know, where are the feet? Are we to believe that footprints evolved millions of years before feet? And it gets worse than that, by the way. Most of these footprints actually head northwest. Now, are we to believe that for millions of years, animals mainly walked northwest? This strikes me as a rather instantaneous sample, or at least a very short-term sample of life on Earth. I believe it is representative of maybe the time of the flood or the runoff of water after the flood, and these animals were moving in a particular direction for some reason, possibly against the current of water or whatever.
Let's take a break right here. I'm intrigued by your interpretation of the facts because, of course, there are many who would say, golly, that maybe it even fits within a different timeline, one of a very old Earth. We're talking about the age of the Earth. Do you believe in a young or an old Earth? Give us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE. 877-623-6943, or email your question or comments to talkback@issuesetc.org. talkback@issuesetc.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. David Menton is our guest. We're talking about the age of the Earth.
Noted author and history professor Dr. Paul Meyer on the uniqueness of Issues Etc.
I'm delighted not only to listen to Issues Etc., but also to have the privilege of being on the program from time to time. Issues is never afraid to take a stand on the thorny, vexing issues that clutter our daily horizons. And it does so in the name of a solidly based Christianity that doesn't flirt with fads or fantasies. Whereas some Christian programs sidestep ethical and doctrinal questions in our day, Issues takes them head-on in a fearless, responsible, thoughtful manner. Both head and heart are involved when Issues applies Holy Scripture.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a gift today. Donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check, Lutheran Public Radio, Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
A letter you would never want to receive.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Some members of the Oregon State Health Plan are getting alarming responses to their request for potentially life-saving medicine. At least two members of the state-run health plan for low-income residents have received letters saying that while the state would not pay for the chemotherapy their doctor ordered, it would be willing to pay the costs of a physician-assisted suicide. Fortunately, both individuals brought their letters to the attention of the media, including Fox News, and ultimately got the Oregon health plan to pay for their medicine.
Are you pro-life? Then visit our website at sba-list.org and discover how you can make a difference. I'm Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. Thanks for taking a stand.
Our whole universe was in a hot, dense state than nearly 14 billion years ago. Expansion started. Wait, the earth began to cool. The autotrophs began to drool. Neanderthals developed tools. We built a wall.
We built the pyramids.
Math, science, history, unraveling the mystery that all started with a big bang.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Dr. David Menton is our guest. We're talking about the age of the Earth. He's a speaker for Answers in Genesis, based in Petersburg, Kentucky, associate professor emeritus of anatomy at Washington University School of Medicine. In about 15 minutes, we'll discuss Jesus is King with Dr. Arthur Just. Before we went to the break, you were talking about the footprints that can be found at a certain layer at the Grand Canyon. You said that it looks to you like evidence of animals traveling in or around the time of the Great Flood. How many of the fossils do you think can be explained, the rapid burial and fossilization of these animals that we find simply by the flood event that's described in the book of Genesis?
Well, you know, my colleague here and my boss, Mr. Ken Ham, who founded Answers in Genesis, he has a comment he always likes to make, and that is, if there really were a worldwide flood, you'd expect billions of dead things buried in rock layers deposited by water all over the earth. But when you actually go out there and look, what do you see in the fossil record? You see billions of dead things buried in rock layers deposited by water all over the earth. I can't imagine a more compelling record of the devastating effects of the Noachian flood than the fossil record we have. Now, not all fossils were formed during the flood. One of the debates that goes on among creationists is which of the fossils might have been pre-flood. Or if not fossils, at least earth strata. Most would say certainly the pre-Cambrian, what we call pre-Cambrian, would be pre-flood. Which of the layers of the so-called geological column are likely to be made during the flood and which after the flood? And this is a debated point. Nobody was there to actually observe these deposits happening. But I believe that the pre-flood flood and post-flood events or a better explanation for the catastrophic formation of fossils. Because today, you know, when you think about it, if you have a dog or you have a cat and the dog or cat dies, does it make a fossil? All these rabbits and squirrels we got running around in our yard, when they die, do they make a fossil? Even in the lakes, when our fish die, do they make a fossil? If you go down to the bottom of a lake, do you find lots of fossils being made down there? No, the conditions necessary to produce a fossil are catastrophic in nature. And so I believe the fossil record is giving us a relatively short-term view of the animals and plants that have lived on this earth, not necessarily in any particular developmental order, but nonetheless a short-term glimpse of what was alive in the past. And the interesting thing is about anywhere from 70 to 90% of all the living genera of plants and animals that we see on earth today have been found in the fossil record. So the fossil record is not a bad record. It's remarkably complete because we find so many of our living plants and animals in the fossil record. You see oak trees, you see elm trees, you see sycamores. Almost every kind of creature can be seen, many of them in the same sorts of strata that dinosaurs are found in. So it's not a record of long sequential progress, nor is it even a record of God's long-term progressive creation.
Joe is calling from his car. Thanks for being patient, Joe, and welcome.
Hi, Todd. I have a question. If say, archaeological digs over in the Middle East or wherever might be, you know, 20, 30, 100 feet under dirt or sediment or whatever, why wouldn't 70-million-year-old fossils or footprints or something like that be thousands or, you know, miles underneath Earth? I mean, doesn't the Earth shift enough? Isn't there enough natural erosion, that kind of thing, that these things would be just buried beyond where we could ever find them if the Earth were really that old?
Good question, Joe. Thank you very much. I've wondered that myself, Dr. Menton.
Yeah, I guess if the sedimentary if the present is the key to the past, that's a good question. But I don't think the present is necessarily a key to the past. Catastrophic events can produce what we see in very short time courses. Grand Canyon, for example, today we have a river running in the bottom that slowly erodes the strata through which it's running. But I believe that whole canyon was cut very quickly by a body of water that has really nothing to do with the river that runs down there today. Probably the breach of an ice dam from water captured after the flood that suddenly come through and cut this strata. Even the evolutionist estimates of the age of the canyon, you know, are have changed and today are much shorter than they used to be. But, you know, when it comes to erosion and deposit, here's something I've thought of a great deal. When we look at the surface of the Earth today, we see it deeply inscribed by rivers and canyons, right? We see lots of erosional events on the surface. Recently, I was at the museum in Pittsburgh, the Carnegie Mellon Museum, and they had a cross-sectional model of the city of Pittsburgh and the strata that are underneath, which they well know due to all mining and everything in that area. And on the surface, you have this very corrugated, very eroded surface that cuts down deeply into the layers. But once you get down into these layers, they're like tabletop smooth. And so if each of these layers in our geological column are supposed to represent the horizon of millions of years in their own right, why aren't these layers showing us underground erosional events and caves? And, for example, meteoritic impact sites, we see them all over on Earth today at the surface. But when you go down well below the surface of the Earth, you don't see a meteorite impact site that begins hundreds of feet below the Earth in a stratum there. It's as though the surface we have today has been around for a very long time, I would say basically since the flood. And once you get below that surface and see the layers, you see no evidence of horizons that look anything like the Earth horizon looks today.
Anne is listening in St. Louis. Anne, thank you for being patient.
Oh, thank you very much. I have two things that I wanted to say. First of all, I was an art teacher, not a scientist. But I heard somewhere along the line that the second law of thermodynamics says that everything is winding down. That's physics, I think. But then evolution says things are improving. I wonder how do scientists reconcile these two things? And the other thing I wanted to say, I wanted to recommend the book Genesis and the Dinosaurs by Eric von Fange. I think that was his name. I don't know that it's available anymore, but it's so good in addressing the things you're talking about and has a lot of other interesting things that are worth reading about.
Anne, thank you very much. Thanks for the recommendation. Dr. Menton, entropy, all things winding down, is there an attempt to reconcile this with the evolutionary theory in general?
Well, certainly evolutionists have to have rescuing hypotheses for every criticism that comes along. So, for example, we know the second law means that everything over the course of time, and the second law has been applied far more widely than just boring holes in cannons, which originally gave rise to the second law. It applies to information theory. It applies to all sorts of things, and that is, over time, things break down. In fact, you often hear of what is called the heat death of the universe, that eventually all of the energy will no longer be available in the universe. It will all be expended and reach a state that is its lowest common denominator, and there will be no heat, and the Earth will become absolute zero Kelvin, and molecular motion will cease. The sun, of course, will burn out in time. It's like a candle. It's burning, and so it'll burn out. The stars will burn out. We should have already lost our sun a very long time ago. There shouldn't be any short-period comets left because every time they come through our atmosphere and they get near the sun, or not our atmosphere, but into our solar system, they get near the sun, and a good portion of the comet burns off, and they should have been long gone. So evolutionists come up with a rescuing hypothesis. They say, well, there's an Oort layer out there that makes these comets that can keep feeding them in. Now, you can't see this layer, but they propose that it's there or else we wouldn't have any short-period comets. But I think the second law is a compelling argument against evolution. What does the evolutionist respond? This is their response. They say that, well, the second law only really works in a closed environment. Our Earth is an open environment. Energy is coming in from the sun, and the energy being expended from the sun is making a local increase in organization here on Earth. They would use the example of water doesn't go uphill, but when the energy from the sun comes in, the water evaporates and can go up into the sky. The problem is you can't produce anything remotely like the complexity of biological systems just with the expenditure of energy from the sun alone. You need some organizational process. You can't build automobiles in an automobile plant just with energy and material. You need to have the architecture and the planning of the whole plant to assemble this car. So I think it is a compelling argument. Evolutionists try to get out from it by saying, well, it's an open system. Energy keeps coming in, and therefore we're able to go uphill.
Finally, then, with only 30 seconds, is there any evidence that we find in the planet around us that the Earth is immensely old rather than perhaps only tens of thousands of years old, as would a simple reading of the Genesis account indicate?
Yeah, I think, for example, the strongest evidence for old age is the amount of radioactive products that we see out there. And if the present is the key to the past, we look at the rate at which products break down. We have radioactive decay products, which would give the impression of having been formed over a very long period of time. The RATE Committee in California, a group of creationists, have studied this, and they've shown that, yes, these products are there, but they appear to have occurred over a much faster rate than we would expect today. To me, the evidence from the Bible is still the best evidence. God says he created the heavens and earth, and he created man from the beginning. Jesus Christ says from the beginning he made them male and female. That we should leave our parents and cleave to our wife, and the two become one flesh. Christ believed in a young earth. He believed in human beings around from the very beginning. That satisfies me.
Dr. David Menton is a speaker for Answers in Genesis based in Petersburg, Kentucky, Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University School of Medicine. It's always a pleasure talking with you. Dr. Menton, thanks for being our guest.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Folks, we have a link posted to Answers in Genesis under the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. Right after this break, Dr. Arthur Just will join us. We'll conclude our series with him, Jesus as King. Stay tuned. We're destined to be Darwin's children this time.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues, Etc. 24/7? Check out our website, issuesetc.org, and click on-demand audio. Listen at the gym, in your kitchen, in your garden, on your iPod, your computer, or in your car. The technology may be new, but the truth never changes. Issues, Etc. on-demand audio, available for your convenience at issuesetc.org. 10 hours of new programming each week, issuesetc.org, and click on-demand audio.
Aim, spit, and then catch.
Answers with Ken Ham, whose ministry has opened an evangelistic creation museum and planetarium near Cincinnati, Ohio.
The archerfish has the incredible ability to shoot down insects with a well-aimed spit of water. It can also calculate just where its prey will eventually fall. In fact, the fish starts moving towards the landing spot of its prey within 100 milliseconds of a hit, twice as fast as an average human. And it's amazing how the fish carries out this calculation and rushes straight to the right spot. The brain of an archerfish is actually capable of complex mathematics, including trigonometry and calculus. The programming required for this is very advanced, but it would also be useless unless it was fully functional to start with. Since we've never seen natural processes giving rise to programmed information like this, the fully formed program for this fish function is evidence of an intelligent programmer. The Creator God programmed all this right from the beginning. You know, this is just one more example that clearly shows the impossibility that life could have arisen by chance processes of evolution.
During this election time in America, one of the hot topics is global warming. For our perspective, request our DVD when you present our nonprofit ministry with a gift of any size. You can obtain the DVD when you call toll-free 888-89-ANSWERS, 888-89-ANSWERS, or go to our website, answersoffer.org.